You are listening to an edited version of Get Radio's Business Brunch, which airs every Sunday at 11 a.m. on DAB Digital Radio across Oxfordshire and online at getradio.co.uk. For copyright reasons, we cannot play the songs mentioned in the show. But for more info and Business Brunch related content, head over to getradio.co.uk.
Get Radio's Business Brunch with Ben Thompson, sponsored by the Oxford Business Community Network. The friendly, no-pressure networking group for Oxfordshire's business people. Discover our membership packages to help you grow your business at obcn.co.uk.
Good morning, happy Sunday. This is Get Radio and welcome to the Business Brunch with me, Ben Thompson, owner of Thompson & Terry Recruitment. Every week during the show, we share the stories, the expertise and the knowledge of business leaders large and small with you, the listener. And this week is going to be no different. On today's show, I'm really excited to be joined by Frank Webster of FC Webster Consulting. And we're going to be talking about property here in Oxfordshire. We're going to be providing an update there, but also we're going to be talking about scaling a property business and really the intricacies. I can't say the word this morning, apologies. All around property. So it's going to be a really interesting conversation. This is the Business Brunch. I really look forward to welcoming Frank after this. Get Radio. Welcome back to the Business Brunch here on Get Radio. If you are just tuning in, today we're joined by Frank Webster of FC Webster Consulting, and we're going to be talking about all things property. So let's start by introducing Frank for those who don't know. Frank, welcome.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Ben. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Frank, so for those who don't know you, can you just give us a little bit around you and your background? Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I'm Oxfordshire born and bred, born in Bicester. My father was a police officer and we sort of moved around, but mainly here in Oxford, where I spent really my life and obviously my career. So I ended up initially going to Germany, but that didn't work out. Came back and fell into estate agency. And then that morphed into property management and letting. And now I found myself still very involved in the industry, albeit in a part-time capacity.
Amazing. And lots to talk about around those topics over the rest of the show. So thank you for that. The toughest question that we find that all of our guests are asked, because we're all such experts within our field, aren't we? But it's so difficult to pick a song on the radio. So no pressure, but you have kindly chosen a song for our listeners. What's your song choice and why have you picked it?
I have. It's a Beatles classic, The Long and Winding Road. No real connection to Mig, although it has seemingly been a sort of long and often winding road. But I just love the song and I just think it's got great melody. It's just a great song.
Oxfordshire Station, Get Radio.
Welcome back to the Business Brunch here on Get Radio. Following that great song chosen by Frank, which I think has real connections, doesn't it, to business in general. It is a long and winding road for any business. We heard a little bit about Frank's background, and today we're going to be talking about an update on property in Oxfordshire, and we're also going to be talking lots about scaling a property business, which I think a lot of our listeners will be really interested in. So let's start by talking about property. So I think that there's been lots that has been reported in terms of interest rates and then the budget more recently, et cetera, et cetera. So let's start with, how is property in Oxfordshire right now?
Well, it's bullish and it always has been, and I think it always will be, Ben. I mean, it's got some enduring factors, Oxfordshire, many unique characteristics. You know, we're very lucky in many respects, although there is a downside. We're lucky because we've got, you know, amazing, strong road and rail links. It's a very affluent county, sort of amazing and robust knowledge economy, world-famous university. We're surrounded by lovely market towns. We've got great state and private schooling. So what's not to like? The downside is obviously we've got floodplains, which is very apparent at the moment around Oxfordshire. We have a lack of land for development, and all those mean that there's a constraint, you know, on our ability to build properties, and that's always been the case. So you have a supply and demand imbalance. Therefore, I think, you know, you're always going to have basic economics. It's a great place to live, but there are some downsides, and it's an incredibly difficult problem to solve. But the market itself is bullish. We always beat the national statistics in terms of property gain, and that's why it's not only a great place to live, but it's a great place to invest. But it's quite an expensive place to invest these days.
No, absolutely. And one of the things you touched on there is in terms of we beat the national average. If you look at Oxford in comparison to the wider UK, are you, through your network, are you seeing wider challenges in property across the UK as a result of said budget or interest rates or whatever else?
Yeah, it's very interesting. When I first got into property, I was quite young. I didn't really understand property, if I'm honest. I hadn't even bought my own house at that stage. So it's quite bizarre that there I was, a young estate agent. I was still living with my parents. But you learn rapidly. The thing about Oxford, as I say, is these incredibly difficult sort of house prices. So they're very high. And now, when I first bought my own house, my earnings ratio to the house price ratio was sort of more realistic and achievable. But the massive thing that's changed now is obviously the prices have gone up massively, and certainly our salaries and the multiples you need now and the deposit required. So that's a problem throughout the country. Renting's become more and more popular over the years, having been very popular in the Victorian days, and then it sort of waned, and we had the wars, and we built loads of houses after the Second World War. Very good at building houses, we had to. But increasingly, sort of in the late 60s and 70s onwards, we've just not built enough houses. We also allow people to buy their own local authority houses. And what that's meant is that the money that the local authorities got from selling those properties didn't, or they weren't forced to put it back into building social homes. So we've got this imbalance, and the people that would have rented in the social market and sort of tripped into the private rented sector. So the private rented sector's sort of grown, exponentially, and has really been the crutch that supported, everybody. So we've got a real problem. It's difficult to get on the housing ladder. Now it's quite difficult to get into the private rented sector. And it's an enormous challenge across the country for any government and local authorities. Everybody's got the same problems. Planning is quite laborious and expensive and painful. So we just seem to have lost the ability to, have a default that we had after the war of, yes, let's get building. And it's been the opposite, really, with people sort of against development. And we've got a lot of catching up to do. So it's complex.
No, absolutely. Let's break that up a little bit, because I think that some of our regular listeners will be landlords, and that may range from a single rental property to bigger scale developments. But I think it's been widely reported that it makes less commercial sense now to be a private landlord, or certainly to own the property yourself in your own name. And it's been reported that a lot are leaving the sector. Is that what you're seeing on the ground here in Oxfordshire? Shed a little bit of light on what's happening with the private landlord.
I never believe anything you read in the press. And if you do read the press, you would think that there's a massive exodus of landlords. And indeed, if you think about how buy-to-let came about and the Housing Act, which was the first big change to the housing laws in the late 80s, and we're about to see another massive change next year, by the way. We come on to that perhaps, but yes, the sort of issue with the whole of the sort of thing for landlords now is a lot of them bought many years ago and they're of a certain age, and the reason for buying, particularly here in Oxfordshire, is that you're investing your money and you may be borrowing as well to leverage that acquisition, but you're really investing for everything I've just mentioned about Oxfordshire. It's really like investing a gold bar somewhere, or buying in gold bar, because it's so resistant to the effects of the worldwide sort of issues around here in Oxfordshire for those reasons I described earlier. So you're bound to see a capital gain unless you buy unwisely, but if you buy wisely and at the right time and you sell at the right time, you're likely to see a capital gain, and you also derive an income. So, we've had a very low interest, a period of low interest rates. So it's been very difficult for savers to glean much. But if you owned a property, you've been seeing a capital gain, often double digit, plus income. So that's actually quite an impressive investment. And if you look at the numbers, property increases have sort of outgrown gilts and, other sort of indexes. The downside now is obviously the high outlay. So for any new landlord wanting to invest here in Oxfordshire, you will need a reasonably good deposit. But interest rates, are still relatively low. When I bought my first house, interest rates were 15%. And people say to me now, why did you pay 15%? Well, you didn't have any choice. That was the lending rate at the time. So the rates we've had, you know, recently have been ridiculously low, really. It's almost free money. And even now, they've bounced up and but gone down to sort of, you know, 3-4%. You can get buy-to-let mortgages that are now in the 3-3.5% range if you search and know where to look. You know, so I think we're not seeing an exodus, and I wouldn't advise anybody to exit unless they really need to. What I would advise people to do is work on how you retain that property wealth in the family. It's like a business. At some point, you know, you'll get to the point where you want to sell, but unless you don't need to sell, don't listen to the press, listen to experts, you know, have a plan and a strategy. But I'm certainly, you know, we're not seeing in Oxfordshire lots of people exiting for the reasons that I've just described.
You make a really good point there, actually, Frank, because I think one of the real traits across 200 of these shows has been very much listen to experts. And let's focus on the press piece. Can the press be damaging? And do you find across your career that a lot of people will see the news or see a newspaper, reliable or not reliable, and say, oh, interest rates are going to fly up, or landlords need to leave, and some will literally go and sell as a result of that potentially bad advice?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all about sensationalism, isn't it? And sort of, you know, headline grabbing. And we often get the one about rents that have risen, you know, ridiculously and what have you. But if you look at the data, rents historically rise, you know, along with inflation. You know, agents, landlords can't bust the market. Sometimes there are pinch points where there's a real lack of supply, and you might get certain areas where people want to live for some particular reason, like a school, or, you know, whatever's going on in the area that drives that value higher. It's market forces at the end of the day. Most landlords aren't incredibly greedy people. You know, they listen to their agent's advice, they go along with that advice on the whole. So, and if you look at the data, which unfortunately the press don't, you will see that, you know, apart from spikes every now and again, rents, as I said before, do keep pace with inflation, really, and house prices as well. Yeah, I mean, I think certain charities have recently had strong voices and managed to work their way into government. And there's been a lot of misunderstanding about the rental sector, and the press have picked up on that. So it's demonised landlords, and it's sort of demonised agents that are doing their best to, you know, give tenants a roof over their head and manage these properties. And that's a great shame, because the reality is, as I say, most agents and landlords aren't trying to force their tenants out or push rents up so that people can't afford them. It's the opposite.
Absolutely. And I've always been a big believer in it's important to encourage entrepreneurial ship in the UK. And I think that my own story, and I'm by no means a landlord really, but when I was 20, I bought a rental property and stayed living at home with my mum and dad, and then I remortgaged it a year later, and purposely got a mortgage that I could remortgage and bought another one. And when all my friends were buying cars that were devaluing at a huge rate, my properties were going up and up. And I think that really we should be encouraging our young people, if they're able to do that, to do that, shouldn't we?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the negative sort of, because the trouble is, you have to win votes as a politician, and you know, it's this constant drive for votes. So obviously, a lot of renters now, and there was the Cecil, where we've got sort of owner occupancy versus people renting, tipped not so long ago, so there were more people renting than there were owner occupiers. So if you're a government and you want to get elected, you know, you need to think, what's the cohort of voters? Well, if they're all renters, you've got to try and woo them and appeal to them. So all the sort of strategies have been linked to, you know, I'm sorry to sound skeptical here, but I see this as a fact, that that's what the governments do. So they make these sort of pronouncements that they're going to do this, that and the other, and bring rents down and stop landlords doing this. And the reality is, you need to encourage a healthy sort of housing sector, full stop. You have to have sufficient social housing, you have to have sufficient private rented sector housing, and you have to make it as easy as it is possible these days for people to, you know, get on the mortgage ladder. And I think the mistake governments make is they think everybody wants to be a homeowner. but not everybody wants to be a homeowner. It's a nice aspiration, and it's great if you do own your own home. The caveat being, of course, you don't own your own home until you've paid the mortgage off. But, you know, renting suits many people. Two of my children moved around the country with their jobs, used private renting as the means of putting a roof over their heads, and eventually did end up wanting to have their own house. But unless you've got this balance of the right sort of sections in the housing, overall housing sector, you know, you're going to have an imbalance, and we've got lots of imbalances at the moment. As I say, it's a massive problem for government to try and resolve. But your personal description, as you've just described, is what really we should be encouraging. And I think younger people do understand about property, particularly if they've sort of been brought up in and around Oxford. And we just need sort of better mechanisms for retaining property, as I say, the wealth of property in the family, really.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. No, really, really, really interesting. Frank, thank you so much for your thoughts so far. We'll continue the conversation after this.
Interviewing Oxfordshire's business leaders. This is the Business Brunch Podcast, sponsored by the Oxford Business Community Network. Build relationships with the ultimate goal of growing your business. obcn.co.uk.
Welcome back to the Business Brunch here on Get Radio. If you are just tuning in, we're joined today by Frank Webster of FC Webster Consulting. And so far, we've given insight, or Frank's given insight, to where we're at with the current property market here in Oxfordshire. And we've spoken a little bit about probably mainly the rental market. So I'm keen to build on something that we've touched on before in terms of after the Second World War, houses were going up at a good rate. The ambition, if we believe what government say, is to build a lot more houses. What is the process of building a house, if you don't mind me asking, in terms of, is it difficult if you've got a piece of land to build a property? And then, of course, we're going up to the Taylor Wimpeys of this world where we're potentially doubling the size of town. So give you a little bit of an insight for those who don't know that process. It'd be really interesting.
Yeah, it's got incredibly complicated. Obviously, finding the land in the first place and then having the money to buy that land. I mean, around where I live, we've got buildings being knocked down for massive sums of money. And then it costs money, obviously, to construct the building. But before that, the planning permissions, sometimes it can take many years, and you have to employ consultants and advisors. And then there's in Oxford itself, there's obviously restrictions because of the shortage of land on how many you can build and how many you must give across to the local authority for their allocation of social housing. So, if you like, it's a bit of a sort of planning bribe where the local authorities rely on developers to build sufficient houses for them. So roughly it's about 50% now. So if you and I owned a plot of land and we wanted to build 10 houses, we would give 5 as part of that planning process to the local authority. So we've got to think about that in all our maths, because effectively those are given gratis. So we would then be relying on making money by selling the 5 houses that, you know, we would retain. Along with that, you've got all the sort of extra energy green type sort of issues that are now get built into everything. So there's a huge number of things to factor in. And then getting through that planning hurdle is a sort of another sort of big issue. And it's not easier, I don't think, if you're a big developer these days than a small developer. So, it can take many, many years. And if there's appeals, it will take longer. And that's where local authorities struggle, because any appeal is normally council taxpayers' money that they use to defend, you know, if they're unhappy or want that development curtailed or changed in some way. I mean, I'm not a planning expert, but, you know, being involved in the industry, that's where we are, really. So each government comes along and they think, well, we'll change the planning policy. So they rip up the previous government's planning policy, and then everybody has to get used to a new regime. And this has been going on and on and on. And, you know, developers are often sort of blamed that they sit on land and they release only a minimal amount of houses, you know, to retain the value. So there's lots of sort of arguments there, and they would deny that. It's a sort of hugely complex situation, and if you're building within the city, center. You know, you've really got to accept that you've got a huge battle on your hands. And then, as I say, we've got floodland and other more complicated issues around us, and greenbelt land that prohibits and restricts building. So it's very complicated.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So one of the things I've done recently is joined a networking organization, and two of the members, one of them is Ecology by Design. So they're looking at plots of land and how do you keep the ecology, and DevComs, who are working with big developments in terms of that PR piece around it. And being really honest, hosting a business show for the last 4 years, I thought I knew a bit about business, and I didn't realize the complexities that actually developers have to go through. And it's really interesting, isn't it, in terms of there's one angle where the government are saying, do you know what, we need to build lots and lots more houses, but then there's the other angle in terms of actually it's going to be more difficult to get planning for those houses.
Yeah,
do you see something changing there?
Well, I think the other thing is who's going to build them? Because, you know, under the Blair government, we had a big drive to send everybody to university, which is fine. Two of my children went to university. The other didn't. And it's not for everybody. The issue is, of course, if everybody goes to study at university and they're not learning practical skills such as bricklaying, you know, becoming an electrician, a heating engineer. And obviously with the immigration sort of complicated issues linked to that, we have a limited skill base. So going back to your earlier question, my dubious or my doubt that we'll ever meet these huge targets, 1.5 million homes that they're going to build in this sort of government term, I can't see it happening. I really can't. And I think, again, it's disingenuous to be sort of shouting out sort of figures like that when you pretty well know you're not going to achieve it. You know, cost of building materials is also another issue for developers. You know, we've had a huge spike in building material costs, and all that filters back obviously to the price that you ultimately need to sell that property for. But the skills shortage is a real problem. If we're going to build good quality houses, the other issue we've not talked about is obviously building the right type of houses. And because of land values, you know, I look around here and I see lots of sort of large houses that an element of them are supposed to be affordable, but they're actually on over £1 million. They're sort of four-story townhouses, and I'm thinking, well, that's not good for somebody at the latter stages who wants less staircases. My grandparents used to live in a sort of local authority bungalow that was built, two bedrooms, a little conservatory at the back, and that was perfect for them to downsize, you know, in their latter ages. And you very rarely see single story, you know, bungalows, as we call them, as part, because they take up sort of more space, you know, on land. And I don't think we've got the mix right. And I fear that some of the quality of the housing stock that we're building across the UK is pretty poor. So it's quite complicated, as I've said about six times, I think, on this interview.
Yeah, very, very much so. It's really fascinating, isn't it? Because you make a really valid point in terms of that whole bungalow piece, the amount of individuals at a certain age who really want a bungalow, and it makes sense. But I imagine just the sole reason behind not having more of them is that actually a developer can make more money from said plot of land from building a couple of houses than the one bungalow. So yeah, really, really, really interesting. So let's go on to the social housing side of things, if that's okay. And something that has been reported here, and let's see if how true this is that the rate of which individuals are able to buy a social house has got closer to market value. What do you predict that will do? And do you think that the local authorities will still be wanting to sell those social houses, or how do you see that, I guess, kind of coming out in the wash?
Yeah, I think there's a lot going on at the moment. I'm not expert in that field, but the government are currently reviewing the right to buy sort of rules. And as I say, the mistake has been that the money that the local authorities have received has not gone back into building those homes. So the current government is quite rightly looking at that. It's great, as I say, to be able to allow someone to buy their own home, but not if it's at the expense of then reducing that housing stock down to minimal levels. Housing associations sprung up and have replaced what we used to Noah's sort of council housing authorities. So local authorities, you know, now it's sort of divested into sort of housing associations. It's quite complex mix. We've got shared ownership, you know, outright ownership, social renting. So we are getting there in trying to sort of find a pathway for different sort of tenures. You know, if you look at some of the schemes that are being developed around Oxfordshire, such as the Blenheim Palace sort of scheme in Woodstock, you know, there's a mix of tenures that you know, you can buy outright. There'll be some shared ownership, some private rented and some social rented. And that seems to me a way forward. I think other developments we're going to see away from the social side is more sort of built to rent schemes where, you know, private rented properties are built and owned by equity backed organizations such as, you know, Grainger, Aviva, L&G. You know, L&G have partnered with the university to help the university provide accommodation for their staff, which is always a big issue. You know, growing university, worldwide reputation, you've got to find enough accommodation for people to live. So the university in its own right has its own issues that the wider you know, Oxford economy has in housing. Yeah, as I say, social housing, not my forte, but building enough of them. I think we've had our head in the sand for far too long. There have been opportunities for local authorities to develop more housing. Ox Place, which is part of Oxford City Council's effort to build more social housing, seems to me to be really getting its you know, head in gear now. And they're developing and looking at land wisely, such as parking areas. Obviously, they're trying to discourage parking in Oxford. So if you can build on some of those parking sites, you know, I think that makes sense if you're creating more social housing. So hopefully we'll come out of this with a better balance and a better mix of, you know, social and private sort of housing, whether it be rented or for sale.
Absolutely. It's really interesting, isn't it? I think it's about creating that win-win-win and ensuring that actually there aren't parts of society who don't have anywhere to live. A mutual contact of ours that I think is definitely worth giving a plug is Homeless Oxfordshire, who do amazing work. And in a recent visit to see Tim, the amount of people who don't have somewhere to live, surely that shouldn't be a thing here in Oxfordshire. But at the same time, surely there should be an opportunity for developers to be able to build and to make a living, which I think is really, 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 really important.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Homeless Oxfordshire, not least because I'm a trustee. But why did I become a trustee? Well, because, you know, I've put a roof over people's heads really ever since I became a young estate agent and then latterly in the private rented sector. And I thought, do you know what would be the worst thing for me and anybody? And clearly that is not to have a house or a roof over your head to go home to at the end of the day. And yeah, and the charity, along with many others, and as a collaboration with other charities in Oxford, is doing its best to pick up at that other end of the scale where people, for whatever reason, have ended up in hard times and don't have somewhere to go to. And Oxford actually has got a lot of poverty as much as the wealth and, you know, the high value properties that I described earlier. And it's often sort of, you just don't think of Oxford really of having that, but it's incredibly easy to sort of become in a situation or find yourself in a situation where you don't have a roof over your head. And that's another whole sector of difficulty, is how do you provide enough accommodation? I mean, we went out at one point to sort of try and have more of our own accommodation as a charity. And with a combination of social loans, off we went shopping. And it cost us nearly £1 million to buy four sort of studio apartments in the centre of Oxford.
Wow.
And, you know, and that gives you a sort of idea of the sort of difficulty for a charity that has aspirations, you know, to increase the capacity for homelessness, if you're having to spend £1 million for four small units, which is why we're looking at things like modular housing, you know, and other ways of sort of speeding up providing accommodation. But that's probably another radio show in itself about the complications of scaling up on modular housing and making that affordable. But it still boils down to the land and where you can put the modular unit. So it's incredibly complex.
No, very much so, very much so. And I think it would only be right here to give Homeless Oxfordshire a plug, because you and the team do such wonderful work. So I think if you are listening, all I would love you to do is just go over to the Homeless Oxygen website and just have a look. I think that would be a really, really good thing for everybody to listen to do. Let's have another song and we'll continue the conversation after this.
This is the Business Brunch podcast from Get Radio, sponsored by the Oxford Business Community Network. Discover our membership packages to help you grow your business at obcn.co.uk.
Welcome back to the Business Brunch here on Get Radio. Today, we're joined by Frank Webster of FC Webster Consulting, and we've really been talking about the Oxfordshire property sector. And we've really, thanks to Frank, given a really, really good insight into the different parts of property, whether that be social housing, or more recently, we've spoken about homeless Oxfordshire, right up to developers and landlords. So it's been really interesting. So thank you so far, Frank. Frank, I'm really keen to talk about Finders Keepers, if you don't mind. So you were with Finders Keepers for a long time. You built incredibly well-respected and well-known letting agent and exited. Can you share that story with those listening at home? Because I think it'll be a really interesting one and I think lots of learning.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, it was quite accidental. I bumped into a lady who had started this business called Finders Keepers. I was selling houses at the time, and I ended up selling a house for Mary Channer, who she'd founded this business as a single lady businesswoman back in the 70s. It was incredibly difficult then to become a businesswoman. One bank manager lent her £500 for her to start the business. Others didn't want to know. Things were very different in those days. Thank goodness they've changed. And she started a business called Finders Keepers. It's a quirky name, and that really helped, because being quirky, sometimes being different, really helps in business. And the whole idea was that she was helping people locate and find a property to live in and own. So a lot of our initial clients, or her initial clients, lived overseas. They were academics or working, say, in Hong Kong as a banker. They wanted to retain a foothold in Oxford, i.e. have a property that they could come back to. So she helped buy, which was the finders. That was the finding and going out looking for that property. And then the keepers came secondary, really, which was the sort of looking after that property. It was the concept of guardianship. So immediately in the name, you have a purpose. And that helps to drive that business forward and for the employees to get behind. And she said to me, look, you've been on the other end. You've been selling property for people. Why don't you go switch sides and help me buy property? And I thought, do you know what? That's really interesting. I was having quite a difficult time. Lawyers were having long lunches. Sorry, lawyers, you were then. Things have changed. My livelihood was being affected, not getting these deals over the line. And I'd learned a huge amount with a great surveyor that I work with and the business owner of the estate agency. So I switched and went across to property letting and management. If I'm honest, I didn't really know what I was letting myself in for. It's hugely complex. For the reasons we've partly discussed, a whole different set of skills. But the skills that I'd learned, you know, in my estate agency career about the fundamentals of property, I was able to take with me. And then I had to learn a huge amount about regulation, legislation. And just at the point I started, the Conservative government were looking at changing the legislation behind tenancy law. And we had very difficult, restrictive pro-tenant legislation. They brought in the Housing Act in 88, 89, and that really drove the private rented sector to where it is these days. And it allowed landlords a mandatory right to repossess their property, together with the loan situation of mortgage finance change with the era of buy to let. It used to be difficult to borrow money on a second property, to buy a second property, but that all changed, you know, during the era of lending in what was called buy to let. So the business grew. I mean, it was I joined in 1985. Mary had been running it as a sole trader and limited company for a few years before I joined. I don't know, we had about 60 clients. And we gradually sort of started to increase the number of landlords we were looking after. And we developed a number of offices, bought a number of offices across Oxfordshire, sort of developed a student section as well. Why wouldn't you in Oxford? Although it took us a long time to get to the stage of realizing that there was a need for students and sharers. A lot of professional sharers share. They're not all student. And we developed to about 130 odd staff and 8 offices. And coming full circle, obviously Mary and her husband, who were the majority shareholders, wanted to exit. But we'd done a lot of good things during the time to encourage other members of staff to become shareholders. So we had incentive schemes, and for us to sell, we had to put things in place, such as building up a team that could continue to run that business once we'd got to the point of exiting. So I don't know how much detail you want to go into about how we achieved that, but that in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, we'd love to know more. And I think that team piece is really key. So we've run a lot of shows around exiting your business, and we've spoken to business brokers and lawyers and advisors and people that have looked at employee ownership trusts and management buyouts and trade sales. So it's a really, really fascinating topic. So I'd be really, I think those listening at home would love to know that process behind it.
Yeah, I think so. We got the advice of Investors in People, which was a government initiative at the time. They really helped us to put in place the idea of a business plan. We were just on the roller coaster, running the business, taking on staff, doing our best. But we realized once we'd had some sort of training ourselves as directors that we had a lot to learn. And by putting a business plan in place with a mission, vision, and sort of sharing that and developing the culture, showing the staff where the business was going, the roadmap. It all sounds very corny, but it's so, so important. So we had job descriptions, we shared the business plan. We took a few pages of the business plan out that was confidential, but essentially all the staff knew when they were joining us and those that were with us, the direction of travel. And those sort of value drivers, there's probably five key value drivers that I see, and it's having a competent team and developing that senior level team. And that becomes ever so important when you want to start to think about exiting. Having strong systems and processes. So we were actually very good at that right from day one, because in property letting and management, if you do not have systems and processes, you will be all over the place. So we were good at that, but we continue to develop that, particularly with IT. It's a classic, like the Amazon thing, isn't it? How easy is your business to deal, how easy for a customer to interact with you? We were always very good on money. So getting money in and getting, making sure we paid our bills on time and looking after our contractors that enabled us to manage the properties, paying our staff reasonable salary. And a big mistake people make, I think particularly in the property industry, but elsewhere, is sort of underselling themselves. And, if you don't bring in enough money, you can't sort of pay your staff a decent salary. They don't feel very good about themselves and they won't stay. So we did look at incentive schemes over the years, which were sort of target driven. So clearly, you don't get anything. It's a carrot and stick approach, but it does work. And then things have evolved now. So, there's employee ownership schemes. We had an employee share scheme, and there were a number of those that evolved over the years. Ultimately, they weren't going to necessarily keep somebody from leaving the business full stop. If they needed to move on in their life, that they would go. But it didn't mean that those that stayed with us for the journey were going to get something out of it, in addition to, hopefully an enjoyable and varied career. And then I think having a large diversified customer base, we were incredibly lucky as we got better at what we were doing and respected for what the advice we were offering. We had, clients literally from all sort of different walks of life, and they were large and small. So we had institutional landlords, we had portfolio landlords, we had individual landlords. And it takes time. I mean, the business when it was sold was sort of 40 plus years old. And we were able to have, with this strategic plan that we worked on many years before we even entered our mind about selling the business. But the strategic plan obviously was ramped up as we decided that an exit was likely. And, it's about driving that value and converting the value of your business into pounds, shillings and pence at the end of the day.
No, absolutely. And one of the things that has come up in every show that we've spoken about in terms of business is about having that plan and actually about having aligned aspirations with your team and having aligned aspirations with the community around you. So no, really, really interesting. Frank, we are coming to the very end of the show. I can't believe how quickly the time's gone. So thank you so much for your input. But one of the things I'd love to do, just as an ending note, is just leave our listeners with a top tip, whether that be something we've not discussed and I've done a terrible job as a host because I've not asked you about it, or whether it be just highlighting something in the notepad from what we've discussed already. What would be your takeaway tip?
I think it's to treat people as you would want to be treated. I know it's a sort of an old saying, but I think that's, I noticed when I joined Mary and other good bosses that I've had to work with and for, is that, you know, if you're looked after, you will look after the person that's looking after you. And I think it's such a sort of basic moral, really, isn't it? And we tried to do the best for our people. Sometimes we didn't get it right, but we tried. And it's all about people, and that property is a sort of secondary thing, really. It's the product. But, you know, you've got to look after your clients. You've got to look after your staff. So I think that's a key tip from me.
Couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. That is the end of the show. So thank you so much for joining us, Frank. It's been a real, real pleasure. If you are just tuning in, you have been listening to The Business Brunch here on Get Radio today. And we've had Frank Webster of FC Webster Consulting. So do be sure to listen back. Next week, we are going to be back with a brand new topic. So next week, we're joined by a really interesting Bicester-based brand called Webmart. They're going to be talking about being a B Corp. They're talking about ideas and insights on how small charities can approach marketing as well. So an area that I know is really, really popular within the charity space. So we've got Alison Chapman of Webmart. So really, really looking forward to that. Just finally, a reminder, you can listen to this show every Sunday on the radio and online at 11 a.m. There is also a podcast version, which is available via all the major podcast platforms and is released on the Monday morning. And do look out for the video format, which is on the Get Radio Facebook page and their website on every Tuesday. But for now, whatever you're doing here in Oxfordshire, enjoy, and we'll see you next week.